Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
I have two teenagers at home, so I am somewhat fluent in the language of, say, TikTok, though not on it myself. And, and so you hear about these people who a year ago nobody knew and now have literally 50, 100 million followers. And you ask, what do they do? And you're like, she dances. Like, you're like professionally trained. You're like, no, like little dances that she comes up with to songs. You know, they're pretty easy to learn. She seems nice enough. And it really is hard and to figure out what the algorithm is behind the scenes that's making this person take off like this. And of course, if any company in the world would love to find out, because they'll do it for their own products or their own spokespeople and so forth. And given that an ordinary person in this day and age can have that happen, it gives hope to anyone that they can too.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Sam, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I, as I was saying here before we hit record, stumbled on your book on Amazon, Situations Matter, which was all about context. And I think part of the reason that must have showed up is I was writing a lot about context and how often it is overlooked by so many of us in almost every decision we make. But before we get into the content of the book, I want to start by asking, what did your parents do for work and how did that end up shaping the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
What did my parents do for work? I just did the thing where I repeated the question, right? So I can give myself a chance to think about how to most articulately answer this, because it's not a question I get often. So my father, when I was growing up, was a English professor at a community college. And so he taught freshman composition and creative writing. My mother was a critical care nurse. And when I was in high school, she actually went back to graduate school and finished her PhD and became a researcher doing clinical research in the field of nursing.
Mm. So, I mean, what influence did that end up having on you? Did they give you any particular advice in terms of career paths to follow? Did they suggest things you shouldn't do with your life?
I think that for both of them, doing what you were passionate about and thought was important was the emphasis. That it was not, I was not growing up in a household where it was, you must do professions X, Y, and Z because you must make a certain income in order to be considered a success. It was very much, what are you passionate about? And I think for my father, his passion was teaching and working with students and helping them develop their writing and doing his own writing. And I think that that's what he was passionate about and that's what he pursued. And I don't think he ever sat down and told me that, but I watched that happen and I saw him in the basement of the old school, analog tape recorder recording verbal comments on students' freshman composition papers so they could revise them for their portfolios. For my mother, it was working with people who needed her assistance and care and comfort and treatment, and then pursuing that later in life with three kids and juggling everything that was going on in our house, and deciding to get her PhD so that she could do research on the kinds of clinical interventions related to both alcohol-related trauma and car accidents and diagnostic tools for better assessing victims of sexual assault, and doing that work because she thought it was important, not because it was easy. And I think I more observed that rather than had anyone instruct me that that's what I should do.
What in the world led you down the path where you would actually write a book about something like context? Because it's such a subtle, nuanced subject that plays such a huge role in our lives. Because, this is, to me, like almost every guest I have, is not something that the high school guidance counselor says, yeah, here's a potentially good career option for you.
Yeah, I found myself as a college freshman going to a liberal arts college to major in English or Spanish or something like that. And I found myself in an intro psych course because it was just sort of the thing you did. People were taking it. My friends were taking it. And I thought, why not? And what that course did for me was open my eyes to the idea that a lot of the conversations that I have and had had in my life with my friends at the mall food court or with my brothers around the dinner table or just in whatever context about why people were acting the way they were and just human nature more generally, that there was a way to approach that through a scientific lens. And that became my career path. That became what I wanted to do. And I took courses, more courses in psychology and behavioral sciences more generally, and found my niche within social psychology, a field that really has as its underlying credo this idea that situations matter, that very small, seemingly small aspects of our ordinary environments and circumstances can have a huge effect on how we think and feel and act. And that was my path. And I started to conduct research, and I started to teach my courses in this field. And the book really grew out of that, this desire to share with a more general audience this power that context has to shape human nature.
Yeah. Well, speaking of context, why do you think it is that somebody like you could recognize, you know, that early in your life that, hey, wow, there's something here that I clearly have an interest in and a passion for, versus, you know, I mean, I went to Berkeley 4 years, and I can tell you, I can't really tell you much about any classes that I think had enough of an impact to say, oh, this is going to shape and influence where I do, you know, where I go with my career.
Luck. Some of it's luck, right? Some of it is finding yourself in the right spots. And I'm sure that your experiences in college, but also before and after, have had, you know, sort of countless influences in shaping who you are and the way you think today. Even if it's, some of it is to reject a certain class or experience or viewpoint and say, that's not for me, and so forth. And I, at some level, perhaps I was just fortuitous and lucky to find myself in these classes in a small sort of liberal arts setting where I could really go in depth into them. And it sparked something sort of within me that I think had already been there in some of the classes I had taken in high school and books I was reading and movies I was into. And I think we all, as goes without saying, you know, take our own paths, and that intersection of what's always captivated us with the environments in which we find ourselves, that interaction plays out differently for different people. And for me, it was relatively early on. It was in college that I sort of had that spark of, this is what I want to do. And fortunately, you know, luckily 20, 25 years later, I'm still doing that, teaching the kinds of courses that at that point I was in. And, but we all sort of take different paths, and that intersection of who we are as people and the environments in which we find ourselves, it's a curious and unpredictable intersection.
Well, so you're a college professor, so there's no way we're going to get out of this conversation without me asking you about education, because I've had a lot of educators here, and my dad is a college professor. But the question for me that always seems to come up is, you know, what is working with education in its current form? What isn't? And how do you see, you know, the material that you teach play out in the lives of your students?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to take the cop-out answer and answer it from my level of analysis, because I have I was just having a conversation with a colleague about this the other day. You know, I have no aspirations for being an administrator, for being a dean who has to wrestle with those questions about what works in higher education, what doesn't. That sounds like I have blinders on, but you know what? What I love about my job is that in ordinary circumstances, you know, pre and hopefully post pandemic, I get to get up, throw on a button down shirt and relatively nice jeans and go in and have really interesting conversations with really interesting and enthusiastic students and colleagues, and call that work. And so what's working in academia and what's working in higher education is what I get to do every day. And in fact, yes, we're in the middle of a pandemic, but later this afternoon, I'm going to drive to my campus and I'm going to put on a mask and I'm going to be in a socially distanced room of 30 undergraduate students who are showing up for a purely optional Q&A discussion section that goes along with the course that they're otherwise taking remotely and asynchronously. And they're going to be there only because they want to be there. And it's not the entire class of 200 some odd students. It's going to be a handful of them who decide to show up for this one session. And we're going to do exactly what I just said. We are just going to have a conversation about whatever strikes us at some level. Yes, it will be tied to the social psychology course that we are taking, but it very much will be, to your question, about how we can apply the material from our class to their daily lives. And we have, in these conversations this semester, certainly talked about the pandemic and certainly talked about the debates and the campaign and the election, but just have talked about their lives in general, and how this lens of viewing the world through this perspective of the ways in which context and situations can shape us, that how that changes the way they're viewing their lives and how that changes their interaction tendencies.
Yeah. Well, you know, because I wonder, you know, when you're talking to these students, what their sort of major existential concerns are, because to me, you know, you think about it, you get older, the context changes, and you start to see things in retrospect that you didn't. So, you know, the example I always come back to is Berkeley is this smorgasbord of opportunity that I didn't see when I was in my 20s, because I thought, oh, my job here is to get as decent grades as possible, get a decent job and get the hell out of here. And now looking back, I always wondered, what the hell was the point of that? There's no need to be in such a hurry. And I only think that that's because the context has changed. Because now that I've spent 10 years talking to people like you, I always think that the experience of going back would be wildly different.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's the biggest of cliches, the idea that college is lost on us when we're young, right? But I mean, I tell my students this all the time, the ones who are, and let me be very clear. My students are often fairly privileged. I'm very privileged to lead this life where this is where I get to do what I get to do for a living. My students who get to go again to a liberal arts environment and play with these ideas intellectually for a period of 3 or 4 years, that's a privileged existence. And yes, some of them pay their own way and some of them are on financial aid. So I'm not even talking about the finances, which is a huge part of it. But, this pandemic has brought into stark, sharp relief for all of us. It should have brought for all of us that we in this country and other countries, people live very different lives, right? And what their day-to-day existence is like. But for someone like me, and maybe your experience at Berkeley was similar. Yeah, it was the same kind of thing that, I was at this elite liberal arts college and I spent, the focus is on having fun and doing well in your classes. And when I talk to my students now at Tufts, I often say to them, they say, well, it's senior year. I'm thinking I'm going to pick up this second minor in whatever. And I'm like, no. I was like, just take a class in art history, take astronomy. Like, this is the opportunity. No one has ever emailed me 10 years later and said, Professor Summers, just wanted to check in. I really regret that I didn't finish that triple major. No one in the history of the world has ever said that. But what they all say is, I should have taken a class in like music of rock and roll or even classical music. Like that was my opportunity. I always wanted to explore genetics. Why didn't I do that? I know I was a psychology and dance major, but I could have taken a course in that because it's not easy to do that later. And that's why people listen to podcasts like yours, right? That's why people buy books like mine. That's why people love the whole TED Talk industry, because it's this effort to recapture what at some level is lost on a lot of us at that younger age, this richness of experience and intellectual stimulation that one can stop and try to appreciate while it's happening. But we rarely do, I think, at that age.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes a perfect setup to getting into the concepts in the book. You open the book by saying, when we look at situations objectively, detaching ourselves from the emotion and bias that often cloud our vision, we're better able to pick up the clues that allow us to understand other people and achieve the outcomes we seek. Now, I think the key words being detach yourself from the emotion and the bias. So one, how does emotion end up clouding our view of context?
Yeah, emotion serves a lot of purposes, a lot of them beneficial, right? There's research that positive emotion sort of broadens what we pay attention to, and we build on previous experiences because of the positive emotions that are associated with the successes or the new opportunities and so forth. But it is also the case that a variety of biases can get in the way from our ability to make the most of our capabilities and the environments in which we find ourselves. I mean, we are remarkably good at protecting the self and the ego from threat and setback and frustration. And that could be a useful buffer so that we can function and get work done even after we get that latest rejection at work, whether it's me sending off a journal article that gets rejected, or whether it's someone who sends their script or their novel somewhere, whatever it is, or just the day-to-day rejections and frustrations we can encounter professionally and personally, buffering our ego through all these biases that allow us to soldier forth and move forward is great in the short term. But we do, when we go through life in this way of protecting ourselves from disappointment and frustration and introspection and improvement, and just recognition of really what's going on around us, that comes with a cost as well. And so a lot of the biases that help us get through our day on a regular basis, when you add them up cumulatively, can be problematic if our true goal is to get a real accurate assessment of human nature, of our own behaviors, of our own foibles, strengths, and limitations. And so I think bias does play a major role like that.
So what role do, you know, experiences like, you know, parents, upbringing, culture, all of that play? You know, so let me just give you a weird example. I moved around a lot as a kid. And I think that, you know, I think as a byproduct of that, my bias is that probably, oh, people aren't going to be around for very long. Another bias, I got fired from a bunch of jobs and my corporations are untrustworthy, you know, based on previous experiences. But I wonder, you know, parents and culture in particular, just because of having grown up in an Indian culture, like I wonder about the context of that and the biases that it probably creates.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about context and situations and environments mattering and having an influence on us. And certainly culture is about as influential and as wide ranging an influence on us as you could come up with. Right. And so whether we're talking about the different belief systems that different parts of the world tend to embrace and then bring with them when they move from one culture to the next. I mean, certainly those we know from the behavioral sciences play a huge role in how we see ourselves and how we see each other and explain each other's behaviors and so forth. The environments in which we first experience life are our caregivers. There's a lot of good research out there on attachment style and how the early attachments that we form with caregivers can persist and be quite evident in our later interactions with romantic partners, but friends and on all sorts of social interactions. And it's not to say that parents dictate and determine our futures, because there's also a fair amount of research that suggests that once you hit a certain age, parental influence is pretty limited and it's your peer groups that really make a difference. And then, of course, there's the other kind of culture to talk about, just the general media and popular culture that we all are steeped in different ways. And so all of these ingredients are part of the complicated algorithm that goes into helping to shape the kind of people that we become. And then, of course, further complicating things, you could have an identical twin for that matter, but a fraternal right. twin or a sibling who goes through the same exact experiences and turns out very differently with some similarities. Yeah,
that was literally going to be my next question. You read my mind because, yeah. you know, I mean, my sister and I couldn't be more different. I mean, right. She's a doctor. She's, you know, one of my friends is like, your sister is like every Indian parent's dream come true, which I'm like, well, I guess that makes me every Indian parent's nightmare come yeah. true, even potentially my own. Because I wondered about that, like how you could have two kids, you know, despite having the same exact upbringing. Now, keep in mind, there is one thing where the context changes. And I actually, there's two major context changes, and I wonder, you know, what research would show about this, like your own research. So when I was, you know, growing up, my dad was actually building his career. You know this experience. He was still doing postdoctoral work, you know, trying to get a teaching position that was a tenure track position. And that didn't happen until I was a sophomore in high school. And also as a result of that, we moved constantly. Like I think I'd been to 13 different schools by the time I got to my final high school in California. My sister, on the other hand, by the time she got to sort of that, you know, formative age of adolescence where everything is really influential, my dad was pretty well established in his career. She also has had the same group of friends that she's known many since sixth grade, whereas I don't think I could tell you anybody that I've known since sixth grade that I would be able to call on the phone and be like, yo, let's have a chat.
Yeah. So what's going on, right?
Yeah, that's what in that context, how do you explain, you know, how we've turned out so differently?
Right. And there's both the beauty and the inherently vexing nature of studying human beings is that we'll never know. And there's it's such a multiply determined set of outcomes here, who we become as people, that it's hard to tease apart even post hoc. But certainly the differences you just identified could be part of it. Could there be differences in people always like to grab onto things like birth order and gender in terms of how parents teach they or interact with their kids and what they expect of them and so forth. I mean, that's often at the top of people's list when they tell you things like, well, I have two kids and, you know, boys will be boys and girls. But there's a lot that could go into that too. But just frankly, you know, the point of the book, just to be clear, and I think I say it in the book, is not to argue that there are no internal differences between people either. Like temperament exists and personality exists. And we come out of the womb differently in some respects. I have two daughters myself, and while they have a fair number of similarities, they're 2 years apart. They have a fair number of differences as well. And those differences were pretty evident from the start. One of them temperamentally just yelled at us for months after she was born and just screamed at us. And the other one was, you know, a delight to take to anywhere. She would ride in the car without having an epic meltdown. And so, you know, there's a lot that goes into this from genetics and temperament and personality that's formed through our early experiences to also that thing that we never really like to attribute outcomes to, and that's sort of chance and fluke and luck, and those things are there, and they are challenging as scientists. And I know this sounds like a bit of a tangent and a segue, but in my mind it's all sort of connected. I've been reading a lot about conspiracy theories recently because this is understandably a hot topic right now, because, well, whether it's politically or related to COVID, there's a lot of that going on around, it would seem. And I think there's an argument to be made that the people who are really unable to relinquish their grasp on these conspiracy theories are the ones who have a hard time coming to grasp with the conclusion that, hey, you know what? Sometimes life stuff just happens and you can't explain it. It happens. You know, a terrible car accident happens, or someone dies at a young age, or the polling error is such that we didn't expect this outcome, but you get another outcome. Sometimes that stuff happens, and you just have to sort of deal with it. And some people are better at tolerating that ambiguity than are others. And you know, I think we can apply that to a lot of the existential questions we ask about ourselves and the others around us.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first chapter of the book is called WYSIWYG, and you actually talk about what you say is the invisibility of situation. You say our social lens is set to shallow focus. We see the world with limited depth of field, blurring the background and accentuating in sharp contrast the action up front. And the question for me that comes from that is, how does this influence the decisions we make when it comes to career, relationships, whatever it is? And how do we make sure that we actually, you know, get a view into all of these things that is a bit more accurate to prevent lousy decisions?
Yeah, I do think we jump to a lot of conclusions. I think we see a small sliver of behavior and we assume that we understand what kind of person we're dealing with. And that phrase, what kind of person we're dealing with, is a challenging one. I mean, I say this as someone who feels that he's a pretty good judge of character and a pretty good sizer up of other people. And I think I've gotten fairly good at that over the years. But at the same time, we have to recognize that we are only getting slivers of individuals in very selected environments. It's not quite as bad as watching reality TV where you only see what the editors have packaged for you.
I know.
Yeah.
Firsthand. I've been on a reality show recently. So.
Oh, is that okay? Well, there you go. So you've got firsthand experience, right? I mean, I have this conversation with my kids with some regularity. It's like, well, you don't know this. I mean, if there's no conflict, there's no show. So they're showing you like the 2 seconds where that went off the rails. The rest of the hour was probably fairly boring. And so, I think in real life, it's not as bad as a reality show editing job, but we only see snippets. My students see me as a recorded image on these asynchronous virtual lectures, and they see me in the classroom for an hour at a time. They don't see me losing patience with my kids over stupid things like parents do. They don't see me struggling to parallel park on the left side of the road in Boston and people are honking at me. They don't see these other aspects of me. And so they feel they have a complete picture of me as an individual. And they don't. And so how do we do that? I think we have to force ourselves to take a step back and ask, am I getting the whole picture here? You know, what's this situation? What are the constraints of this particular interaction and this particular set of circumstances? Is it reasonable to assume that this person, they'd be acting this way if I saw them in this context? And so I do think we have to question the assumptions that we make.
Yeah, I think that's particularly true with public figures. People tend to attribute all sorts of qualities to them. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm anywhere near famous, but enough people know about me that they attribute certain qualities. I think, you know, one of the most ridiculous things I ever heard came from somebody who emailed me. I was like, oh, you must be the most self-actualized person in the world because of the content you create. I was like, no, I'm probably one of the most screwed up people, which is why I create this content. But it's just interesting because, I mean, you see this online in particular, I think, where context is overlooked and, you know, people, like you said, they don't see the whole picture. Because I remember I just finished publishing this piece called The Psychology of Building an Audience on Medium. And context was one of the things that came up. And I said, look, you know, behind closed doors, I say things on a daily basis that are a PR crisis in the making. But I would never say those things on air. You know, it's a very different situation with my listeners. And so, and I think that people, for some reason, don't particularly understand that, particularly when they look at people on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that we, when we see these package depictions of the internet influencer, which is now a word apparently, when we see the politician, I think that we do get that sense that we know people much better than we do. And let's face it, we live in a psychologically fascinating era where, you know, when you and I were in college and we took courses with our professors, they weren't tweeting. You didn't hear anything from them that wasn't part of the lecture, the formal lecture. I wasn't even getting emails from them. It's a very different environment now where you feel like you have a sense of who individuals are because you have so many different input points. And of course, we don't even know who's helming all of those. The social media that we read for celebrities and politicians may very well not be them. But we do have this false sense of intimacy in many respects, I think, with people in this day and age.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. That actually makes a perfect segue to talking about crowds. You know, you talk about the inertia in action and, you know, you say two things here. When no one in the crowd seems concerned by what's going on, each of us feels more comfortable with the status quo, contributing to a cycle of inaction that only continues as new individuals enter the scene. Crowds diffuse responsibility and responsibility diffuses in groups. Chemists talk about diffusion in terms of molecules spreading from areas of high concentration to low concentration, the same thing happens to feelings of obligation and responsibility in a crowd. And to me, what's interesting is there's a paradox almost because it takes a group of people to accomplish something, yet you say that crowds diffuse responsibility. So explain to me how that happens and how, you know, how does that play out in our own lives day to day?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote that. Huh? That sounded pretty good. I like that. That was good. The psychology of being in a group is fascinating because groups both make us do things that we wouldn't ordinarily do or can help us accomplish things we couldn't accomplish on our own. But they also can, in some situations, circumstances, drive us to be passive and inactive and be different people than we would in that regard. And so, you know, we can all think of examples of the former, the idea, well, if you want to move a couch into a new apartment, you probably need a group of people to do it. And moreover, yeah. You can think of the negative examples of what crowds do on spring break or on Black Friday when they can go to the stores in hordes of people. And so being in a crowd can sort of egg people on if you think about protests and riots and so forth. But there's also an aspect of being in a group of people that can be this apathetic kind of experience that can make you feel very passive, because we spend a lot of time in crowds where we're expected to be fairly passive when you're, and again, a lot of this feels like it's pre-post pandemic, but when you're in a crowded movie theater, you're supposed to, for the most part, sit quietly, or a lecture hall, or in public transit, and a crowded city street, you're just trying to get where you need to go, and you put on perceptual blinders to get there. And so, groups can move us in both of those directions. And it's one of the great and pretty robust findings of social psychology, that we are different individuals. Our tendencies, our psychology is different in a crowd, in a group, than it is when we're by ourselves. And that can be used for both positive and for negative outcomes, for, you know, towards both positive and negative ends.
Well, it's funny because I think Annie Duke just, you know, came out with a new book called How to Decide. And she said that often, even when people disagree with something, they'll actually conform to the group. If the consensus is large enough.
Right. Right. So there are these, you know, and I talk about this in the book, and there are these famous studies by Solomon Ash where they show groups of people a series of lines. It's a really easy job. Your job is to say which of these three lines is the same length as this target line over here. And by yourself as an individual, you get it right 99.5% of the time. But if they put you in a group that has actors, and every once in a while the actors give the wrong answer, by the time it gets around to you, you've got a choice. Do I give the answer I know to be right? Do I break with the crowd and give the wrong answer? And it's not that we're mindless automatons. In fact, you know, a third of people never in these studies give the wrong answer, but a good two-thirds of people do with some regularity say that which they know to be wrong, just because it's not worth it. It's not worth the angst and the eyeballs on me and the added psychological heft of trying to go against the group on this. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we can all think of times in our lives where we've done the same.
Well, it's funny you say that, because like I think back to Berkeley and the overwhelming majority of my friends, you know, I mean, it sounds like you probably have been in similar environments. It was kind of a given that you're going to either become a banker, a management consultant, a doctor, or a lawyer. It was, you know, almost like a fast food menu of careers. And so you never think to question whether there are other options. It's almost as if the options in front of you blind you to the possibilities that surround you.
Yeah, it becomes important in like that example I just gave you, to have someone who sort of breaks through and shows you that, you know what, there are assumptions here, there are norms here, they don't have to be followed. I mean, in that study, what Ash found was just having one other person in the group who's willing to break with the group and give the correct answer liberates participants themselves to give the right answer. In fact, just having one person in the group break with the group and give a different wrong answer is enough to make me as an individual feel liberated to give the right answer. It's as if sort of a new norm or a new set of expectations has been authored, or you, your eyes have been opened to it. Oh, I can disagree with these people. That's okay. And there are many times in life where it takes seeing a concrete example of somebody doing something different to make you realize, oh, there is a different way to do it. And of course, those of us who can realize that without the example often are innovators and folks who become quite influential and some, you know, successful and even wealthy because of it.
Yeah. Well, so I think that, that is a perfect setup for our next question, which is somebody listening to this might be like, all right, that sounds lovely. I have a boss who I disagree with, but if I disagree with my boss or challenge his authority, I'll get fired. I think particularly when we have situations where other people have, you know, higher authority or higher status.
Sure.
Going against the grain seems really challenging. So like, what do you say to those people?
Yeah, I mean, it's true, right? I mean, the power that structure and status and authority have on us is pretty well documented. I mean, there are ways to, you know, even with absent the idea of a status difference, if you're in the attitudinal minority in a group, there are times where the minority viewpoint comes to win. And that's by being really consistent and by maybe having built up a store of goodwill by having been a good group member who's towed the line in the past. It liberates you to be a little bit outspoken and go rogue once in a while down the road. But it's a challenge, right? There's no question that when one is put in a position where someone in a higher status authority position has a different viewpoint or tells you to do something you don't feel that you should do, that's an unenviable position to be in. I mean, I think more generally in life, though, there are lessons to be learned that we can shape the normative structures of the situations in which we find ourselves. So, for example, that line judging study, there's no authority figure there. That's just a question of breaking free from the mold of what other people are doing. I think we can apply that to some pretty important stuff that goes on in day-to-day society these days. I mean, just take about as serious an issue as you could come up with. Things, racism and other forms of bias, which unfortunately are on the uptick in our society in the United States and elsewhere in the last couple of years. I think there's often a mentality that someone has said something terrible on social media, but what am I going to do about it? I'm not going to change their opinion. But you know what? Other people see what you say, and other people see the normative structure of the situation based on what isn't said. And when someone says something or encourages workers to do something that's wrong or illegal, when someone says something that's racist or otherwise biased, and nobody speaks up and nobody says anything, there is truth to this idea that silence is complicity. And if people learn that, well, no one's saying anything, I guess it's not appropriate to stand up to this or to say something to the contrary, that influences everyone else. So sometimes I think when you've got the somewhat unhinged relative at Thanksgiving, whether it's on Zoom or otherwise, who's spouting off something that's based in no reality, that's conspiracy theory, or that's racist or otherwise offensive, you might not be able to change that person's mind on Facebook or whatever the domain is and where this is happening. But other people are watching, and other people hear and see what you say. And I think that our responses do shape the normative environments in which other people exist. And that's an important conclusion to keep in mind.
Yeah. Well, let's, you know, get into sort of two practical examples where context plays a role. You know, the first being love, the second, you know, being consumer behavior. But let's start with love. You know, I think this is one of my favorite chapters of the book, you know, just because it was something I related to so much. You say we romanticize about soulmates under, you know, ponder the mysteries of animal magnetism and deem attraction too magical for rational analysis. We prefer our packaged Hollywood style with predestined couples that persevere through near misses before finally landing each other in the end. And, you know, it took an old business partner, a good friend, to wake me up from that reality and say, you see life as a damn Disney movie. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
But talk to me, in terms of context, like how this plays a role in how we choose our life partners and how we can make sure we don't choose the wrong ones.
We do have this sense, I think, and it's both reflected in and shaped by movies and other fictional depictions of, right, there being two people, there being this soulmate that you've got to somehow uncover and find. And I understand the allure of that. It's also fairly daunting. There's, by last count, what, we have 7 billion people in the world right now. And that's pretty much the needle in the haystack idea. And what am I supposed to do if my, you know, the ding to my dong is in Azerbaijan? I mean, that's tough luck for me. I'm not going to find them. I do think that while a lot of people don't like applying a scientific lens to the idea of attraction, what draws us to other, compatibility, relationship satisfaction, that really it should be somewhat liberating. This idea that there are circumstances, environmental factors that make forming connection to someone else, whether we're talking about sort of a romantic sexual connection or just, you know, close friends or work partners or what have you. I think that idea that in the right circumstances, those kinds of relationships are more ripe for the picking than others. That can be a liberating conclusion.
Yeah. Well, it just makes me think. So I alluded to a reality show earlier. It was this thing called Indian matchmaking. And I remember the first conversation I had with a matchmaker, it literally was like, you know, is there a particular school that you want this girl to have gone to? Is there a particular occupation? I was like, lady, I'm not interviewing somebody for a damn job here. Yeah. I'm like, I'm looking for a life partner. But I wonder, so from your research, where do you think she blew it? Because the funny thing about that show is literally none of the couples that she matched were a success. And she's supposedly India's, you know, top matchmaker. Hopefully I don't get sued for saying this. But, you know, journalists have said there hasn't been a single match that was successful that came out of it. And the one girl she said that would be the hardest to match was a girl who was divorced and, you know, in Indian culture for no good reason. That's basically a scarlet letter. And yet that girl is the only one to have gotten married from all the people that were on the show.
Well, it's a hard question to answer. I think that this idea, and a lot of people pay money for dating apps and websites that use an algorithm to say who their perfect partner is. And the formula doesn't seem to work that well. But there are some tried and true conclusions out there about what does predict and facilitate attraction. And some of them are so obvious that they almost seem like they shouldn't be research conclusions, but similarity is one. I mean, birds of a feather flock together gets a whole lot more support than the whole idea of opposites attract. And yes, I know we've all been drawn to people who are very different than we are. And plenty of people are very happy, and whether they're interfaith relationships or Republican and Democrat together or interracial relationships. And that's not the argument no one's arguing against that. But in the aggregate, similar values and experiences and attitudes tend to be attractive to us. It's why we often find ourselves in groups with like-minded other people. Familiarity and proximity are hugely important. Just the more time you spend with someone and cross paths with them, the more positively you are inclined towards them, much as the more often you hear a commercial jingle on the radio with time, even if it's annoying at first, there often becomes a sort of familiarity, and familiarity does seem to breed liking more than contempt. And so it's hard to operationalize those things as a matchmaker, as an algorithm on a dating app.
Well, it's funny you say that, like, you know, think about similarity. I'm like, I told this woman, I'm a surfer, and you matched me with a girl who said she hates the beach. Like,
yeah,
clearly you missed the boat on this.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so exactly. And so I think the ability for shared experience is really important. And maybe at some level, that's what the impetus was for her asking about where the person has gone to school and so forth. But it's really a proxy for something else. So, again, similarity, familiarity, proximity, all really important ingredients that we don't often think about.
Yeah, well, I remember a friend asked me about, you know, this person. I was like, well, I'm like, would you hire Hannibal Lecter to operate on one of your family members? No, that was like my last sort of conclusion about this.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, dating and cannibalism, I got to watch this show now. This sounds great.
Oh yeah, we'll have to talk. You'll have to email me about it and tell me about it through the context of your own research. Well, let's do one other thing. You know, I think part of the reason your work really struck me is when I started looking at purchasing behavior, particularly when it came to purchasing behavior in, you know, online courses, and watching how people looked at authority figures, people who are establishing something, and completely overlooked the context. And let me give you a backdrop for this. You know, somebody who basically is wildly popular online or has a really successful podcast, millions of listeners, goes out and says everybody should start a podcast. And nobody questions that or looks at all the things that fall below it. Like, hey, wait a minute, this person has had a 10-year head start. This person has 70,000 people on their email list to tell about the podcast. You know, there's all these things that nobody considers. So, yeah, I mean, even when you read a sales page, like, of course, the sales page is designed to hide some of the context. I know, because I've written a few of them, not intentionally, but, you know, I know. And this is something that I always tell people is like, look, I won't teach a podcasting course because I can't replicate certain aspects of the context for you. I got a 10-year head start. I had, you know, this amazing mentor. I'm like, that has to be taken into consideration, yet it almost never is.
Yeah. And again, the serendipity of so much. I mean, I have two teenagers at home, so I am somewhat fluent in the language of, say, TikTok, though not on it myself. And, and so you hear about these people who a year ago nobody knew and now have literally 50, 100 million followers. And you ask, what do they do? And like, well, she dances. Like, you're like professionally trained. You're like, no, like little dances that she comes up with to songs. You know, they're pretty easy to learn. She seems nice enough. And it really is hard to figure out what the algorithm is behind the scenes that's making this person take off like this. And of course, if any company in the world would love to find out, because they'll do it for their own products or their own spokespeople and so forth. But given that an ordinary person in this day and age can have that happen, it gives hope to anyone that they can too, right? And so whether it's podcasting, whether it's being the social media influencer, I think it's really hard to, well, you did this, you must know what the formula was, teach it to me. And, you know, the formula was a lot of serendipity and a lot of turns here and there, or in some cases, just flat out luck. And it's hard to recapture, not to mention what you're talking about with, you know, podcasts. Everyone's got to have their own style and their own way of doing it. It's, well, for me, things often go back to Seinfeld, and it's a little bit like the George Costanza storyline where Jerry wants to learn how to lie. And he's like, I can't teach you how to lie. It's like asking Pavarotti to teach you how to sing. I don't know. It's just, it's part of who you are. And so, I'm not a podcaster, but I teach With the style that I have sort of honed or come upon or fallen into after 20 years of doing this work for somebody else? Probably not. And so, you know, I teach much like I wrote that book, much like we're having this conversation in very conversational fashion. And that has turned out to work, I think, for me and for my students, but I don't know that it works for everybody. And it's frankly probably an easier strategy to have be successful as a white male who walks into the classroom and doesn't have a lot of people immediately casting aspersions on my authority and so forth. And so there's so many factors that come into that. It is hard to articulate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just, you know, makes me think, it was like, if somebody tried to reverse engineer my career path, it's like, let me get this straight. Like, if I told you to reverse engineer my career path, it would be a terrible idea. I'm like, I got fired from every job, rejected from every business school, Started a blog. And then by dumb luck, I mean, granted, there was work involved. Somehow my editor stumbled up on, you know, my article on Medium 2 years after I wrote it and said, you know, would you like to write a book? I'm like, you can't. I was like, it would be the height of stupidity to try to reverse engineer that and think it would lead somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just recognizing that is an important part of the whole process as well, because those of us in different domains in very different ways in life, professional, personal, otherwise, who achieve success in any realm, it can be easy sometimes to lose sight of that, to the luck that went into it. That doesn't mean it wasn't hard work, but the luck and various forms of privilege and just the, you know, there are very, very thin margins that separate success from abject failure in a variety of different domains. And that's threatening also. That's a threatening worldview to have. Sometimes looking back, I think it's useful.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's wrap this up. You close the book by saying, you know, we cling to a view of the self as an independent agent unswayed by others. Time and again, we convince ourselves the brief exposures to public behavior allow us to really know someone, only to get burned by the boy next door turned serial killer or moralizing politician caught with his pants down. You know, like, I think about all of this and I wonder, you know, if you could leave us with, you know, sort of one piece of advice not to fall victim to overlooking context, you know, what would you say to people?
I think the moral of the book really has to be just to ask questions, to consistently be less than complacent. I mean, I think that I'm not saying that you take your 30-year long spouse or close friend and say and on a regular basis question them, interrogate them about being a serial killer. That is not the argument here. But just the sense that you know, people are going to consistently surprise us. I think that it's worth keeping that in mind. Even your closest of friends who you've known for decades is capable of things and has done things that you don't know about and that would surprise you. And frankly, I think sometimes we've surprised ourselves with what we're capable of doing. And so, I don't get surprised like that anymore, I guess. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe that makes me cynical. But I think that, I think we have to recognize there is this incredibly broad continuum of human capacity that we all have, and we all make choices, and we're all subject to different circumstances and are faced with different choice sets, some of which are more palatable than our others and more navigable than our others. But, you know, we human beings are fascinating to study and interact with because we are capable of so much. As I tell my students, you know, the terrific and the terrible, right? I mean, just the tremendous examples of heroism and ingenuity and innovation, and then the examples of depravity and cowardice, and sometimes from the same people. And I think that that's an important conclusion to keep in mind.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. So I have one final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What do I think it is that makes someone something unmistakable? And I just did the thing where I repeat the question again, right? So that's the tell that I have to think about that response. I think that we don't know. And I think if we knew, we would all try to capture that and bottle it. I mean, back to our conversation about the unpredictable sudden mega influencer on social media. I don't think we necessarily know. I think that certainly things that violate our expectations are memorable and hard for us to forget. I think things that lead to an emotional resonance in us are things that we remember more deeply and feel more deeply as life moves on. But again, I think that the unpredictability of life in many respects is what makes certain outcomes and certain individuals unmistakable. It's the things that we look back on or the people that we look back on that somehow surprised us, that elicited some sort of emotional response, that violated some expectation or set of assumptions that we had. Those things often stick with us. We like order in the world. We like predictability and things that ruffle those feathers or that undermine that worldview we're trying to reach of feeling things are predictable. Those things are often unmistakable for us.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and insights with us. This has been, you know, funny and insightful and thought provoking. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
They can find me they can find me at my website, www.samsommers.com. Stuff about my books, stuff about my research, speaking opportunities and media coverage and so forth. The books, I've written a couple books, Situations Matter, and then a book on what the world of sports has to tell us about human nature that I wrote with John Wertheim, who's an editor at Sports Illustrated. That one's called Your Brain on Sports. And so those two books are pretty good insights into the kind of work that I do and the kind of stuff that interests me too.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The Four Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.